Iran removes two surveillance cameras of the International Atomic Energy Agency, saying their activity was beyond its commitments under the Safeguards Agreement. Iran's leader describes Hajj as a symbol of unity among Muslims and warns of UK attempts to create rifts between Shias and Sunnis. And Russia says it's ready to help restart grain exports from Ukraine if Kiev cooperates amid concerns about a global food crisis. Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to World News. Our top story, the Board of Governors of the International Atomic Energy Agency have passed an anti-Iran resolution submitted by the U.S. and its three European allies, France, Britain, and Germany. 30 state members voted in favor of the resolution. Russia and China opposed the anti-Iran resolution, while three countries abstained. The resolution accuses Iran of failing to explain uranium traces found at three undeclared sites. It also criticized Tehran for insufficient cooperation with the UN Nuclear Agency. It calls on Iran now to engage with the agency without delay. Iran had already rejected all allegations against the country. Tehran says such measures are in line with political moves to maintain maximum pressure on Iran. Earlier Wednesday, Iran removed two IAEA surveillance cameras, saying their activity was beyond the Tehran's commitments under the Safeguards Agreement.
80% of surveillance cameras are operating under the safeguards of the IAEA. Iran remains committed to their operation and the devices will continue to work. Cameras installed beyond the safeguards obligations will be removed, and we have turned off a number of them. These cameras were put in place to record data to be provided to the IAEA. We won't provide the agency with such data anymore. We hope the nuclear watchdog its approach towards Iran. The IAEA cannot expect Iran to show extensive cooperation in response to non-cooperation.
The Energy Organization of Iran says the IAEA has not only been ungrateful for Iran's extensive cooperation, but has also considered the matter as a duty. Iran's acting ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency says Tehran's remedial measures following U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA are all in compliance with NPT and the 2015 Iran deal.
The root of the existing problem lies in the legal withdrawal of the U.S. from the JCPOA, and the Islamic Republic has taken remedial measures authorized by parliamentary legislation based on the NPT and Articles 23 and 26 of the JCPOA.
Mohammad Reza Qayebi made the remarks on the sidelines of the quarterly meeting of the IAEA's Board of Governors. Qayebi said a recent report by the IAEA's chief on Iran's nuclear program is unbalanced and has provided the U.S. and three European countries with an excuse to submit a politically motivated resolution at the Board of Governors meeting. He said the resolution was unconstructive and damaging. Qayebi said Iran will respond firmly if the U.S. and the Europeans keep pushing for ratification of the resolution. Presidents of Iran and Russia have discussed the need to continue diplomatic efforts and reach an agreement on the revival of the 2015 Iran deal. President Ebrahim Raisi and his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin were speaking over the phone. The Kremlin said two sides expressed willingness to strengthen bilateral cooperation. They also touched on topics regarding regional stability. In particular, the leaders reaffirmed their commitment to work on the facilitation of the Astana talks aimed at resolving the Syria conflict. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has called for strengthening unity among Muslims, warning of Britain's attempts to sow discord among Shias and Sunnis. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei made the remarks during a meeting with organizers of caravans of Iranian Hajj pilgrims. He said the pilgrimage is a manifestation of unity within the Muslim community. Ayatollah Khamenei also hit out at the nexus between some Arab governments and the Israeli regime, saying normalization will be beneficial to none of the Arab states. He said the Arab nations oppose the deals inked by their governments. He added the Israeli regime is exploiting those states. Ayatollah Khamenei also said deals were reached under pressure from the United States. Four Arab countries, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco, have already normalized with Israel under U.S. brokered agreements back in 2020. Palestinians have denounced it as a stab in the back. The Yemenis have slammed what they call the double standard of the international community regarding the conflicts in Yemen, Palestine, and Ukraine. Abdul Latif Al-Washalai reports from Sana'a.
Under the title Collusion and Duplication in International Reports, Yemen's Ministry of Human Rights has held a symposium to discuss the international positions in regards to the conflicts in Yemen, Palestine, and Ukraine.
We have clarified what is happening in the corridors of the UN in terms of double standards, resolutions, and briefings provided by UN Envoy. As the laws enacted by the UN have not been implemented, military confrontation against the enemy is legitimate.
Officials say Western politicians have repeatedly shown their racism towards other nations, especially following the breakout of the Russia-Ukraine war.
There's a double standard confirmed by the abhorrent racism espoused by Western politicians who have said that people with black and brown skin are not able to compete with whites in all aspects of life. What is happening is an erosion of the international community, which stood by Ukraine in the face of Russia, while not moving a finger towards the suffering of Yemenis, Palestinians, and others around the world.
Saudi Arabia, backed by Washington, launched a deadly war on Yemen on March 2015, killing tens of thousands of civilians, including women and children. Yemenis say the international community, including the United Nations, did not take any action to end the suffering of millions of Yemenis.
Experts say the Russia-Ukraine war has exposed double standards by the international community, criticizing it for taking a tough stance on Russia while turning a blind eye to Saudi and Israeli crimes against people in Yemen and Palestine.
Now, with the global food crisis looming, Russia says it's ready to help restart grain exports from Ukraine if Kiev cooperates.
To solve this problem, the only thing needed is for the Ukrainians to let vessels out of their ports, either by demining them or by making out safe corridors. Nothing more is required.
Lavrov was speaking after a meeting with the Turkish Prime Minister in Ankara. He said Russia has already made the necessary commitments to ensure the safety of ships seeking to export grain from Ukraine. Russia and Turkey have agreed for Ukraine's grain exports to be shipped to Turkey and from there to the international market. Kiev earlier said it will not demine its waters as it will lead to more attacks from Russia. Ukraine is one of the biggest grain exporters on the planet. The United Nations previously asked the two countries to start grain exports from Ukraine in order to try to ease a looming food crisis across the world. Now, as fighting rages in Donbas, particularly around the town of Severodonetsk, our correspondents went to the front line with Russian allied forces near another key Russian target.
We're on our way to the front line, outside the key Ukrainian stronghold of Avdiivka. We pull up by the side of the road. It feels like no man's land.
The town is fortified well, but we're working on them, dismantling their dugouts with artillery. We're making passages in their defenses and going deeper. You can hear our volleys now.
Now, it's too dangerous to take the car along this road as it can be a target for anti-tank missiles fired from the Ukrainians, who are just about a kilometer in that direction, so we're going on foot.
These fighters are from the Donbas, now loyal to Russia. They've been fighting here against Ukrainian nationalists for 8 years. Trench warfare has returned once again to Europe. While some of the world's most advanced weapons are slaughtering dozens of soldiers every day, the best defense remains underground. The living quarters, it's infested with kittens. The soldiers tell me that they have them at every outpost. They bring good luck, they say. More likely, much needed comfort in this brutal war.
Now, Avdiivka is just over in that direction there. It's so well fortified that risking a frontal attack would cost so many lives, or indeed may not even be possible. That's why the Russian army is trying to encircle the Ukrainian army to the north of here. And then, after it does that, if it's able to do that, they plan to come down here and take Avdiivka. Because to take Donbass, the whole of Donbass, it's major fortifications like this, which will have to be taken as well.
the remains of mortar shells. The trenches are doing their job. It's been some time since Russia has released its casualty figures, perhaps because the number might be hard for Russian people to swallow. But it's clear, with overwhelming air and artillery superiority, Russia is winning this war, where the fighting is fiercest. The next outpost, as promised, more kittens. Russian soldiers are being dehumanized by Ukrainian propaganda as monsters and orcs, leading to atrocities committed against Russian POWs. But it's clear these soldiers are very human indeed. Upon hearing I was British, one of the soldiers appealed to me to tell the truth about what was happening here to people back in the UK. I asked him what that truth was.
That there's a genocide of the Russian-speaking population going on here. The Ukrainians have been shelling our people for 8 years. They are trying to extinguish us. Tell them about this at least. At any moment, I can die here, but I am on my land and I will fight for it.
No doubt the Ukrainian soldiers in their trenches across the fields will have a very different version of the truth. Compromise is being achieved through war. Appropriately for this European conflict, poppies grow in the trenches. Many years from now, perhaps soldiers from both sides will be able to commemorate their fallen comrades together. But for now, the battle for the Donbass rages on. Jenny Miller, Donbass.
Hospitals across France were deeply impacted by a strike by medical personnel. French public health used to be ranked the best on the planet, but austerity measures have caused a sharp decline in the quality of care. Rami Mazahari reports out of Paris.
With unions showing rare unity, hospitals were brought to a near halt across France due to a major strike. Since the Great Recession began, seemingly no group in France, other than the Yellow Vests, have protested more often than medical workers. France's healthcare system was ranked number one in the world as recently as the year 2000 by the United Nations. However, its quality has plummeted following over a decade of banker bailouts and austerity cuts. Neoliberal economics as applied to public healthcare has created too many complaints by medical workers to list. Frozen salaries, slashed budgets, overwork, closed hospitals, a lack of equipment, gutted morale, and much more. Thousands of medical workers who refused orders to get coronavirus vaccines haven't been reintegrated, even though corona restrictions have ended in France. And that has created even more labor problems.
When you don't replace workers who retire or quit, then you're going to have longer wait times for critical medical care and worsened medical care overall. It's just gotten harder and harder to work at a hospital every year. We now have so few personnel that it feels like every single day is a strike day.
The degraded service has been dramatic and a common topic across France for years. The healthcare system is used by everybody, so politicians haven't been able to limit the negative impact to just the lower classes.
After 5 years of Macron, our healthcare system is in a state of catastrophe. We're seeing more and more people die from a lack of treatment. We have the money inside France already. Just tax the rich and businesses. Go after tax evasion and stop focusing public policy on the richest 20% of society. If we do that, then we'll have good public services and good health care.
The first round of legislative elections are less than a week away. The strike is a black eye for President Emmanuel Macron, just as he's trying to preserve his absolute majority in Parliament, which is crucial for him to be able to force through more neoliberal austerity measures. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
Now, the UK is facing a cost of living crisis that has exacerbated already stifling disparity and austerity. Now people are mobilizing to demand the government bail out the poor and not the rich. Bianca Rahimi tells us more.
The UK marks the Queen's Platinum Jubilee. The royal family paraded the capital over the long bank holiday weekend, and Transport for London finally opened the long-awaited Elizabeth line. But strikes put a damper on things, with members of the Rail, Maritime and Transport Union, desperate for better pay, walked off the job. Rose works for TfL. After a long day on the picket line, she spoke at the People's Assembly. The cost of living crisis has hit hard, but who will bear the brunt?
This is affecting all working people of all different types in all parts of the country, and that means do have to come together. We do need to recognize that we are in this fight together.
The government must act. It must act to make sure that children aren't hungry. It must act to make sure that people don't lose their homes. It must act so that people can go on holiday. That's an important thing as well. And we're going to lose all of that across the next few months unless the government changes course.
The speakers insisted the key to success was unity. Massive rallies are being planned, and people from a myriad of causes will be attending.
We're in a situation now where in the most serious cost of living crisis, the most serious attack on working people that there's been for generations, our government is considering increasing what is already a massive defence budget, a massive arms spending budget. And that seems to us to be completely absurd and actually disgraceful.
The speakers here today warned that dire poverty is knocking on the doors of millions of people across the UK, and the government has no intention of intervening. Record price hikes have already happened, and more is just around the corner.
Food, fuel, energy bills, mortgage premiums, national insurance contributions and tuition fees, name it, the price has gone up. Politicians are blaming the UK's predicament on external factors.
But, Mr. Speaker, the war's most significant impact domestically is on the cost of living. COVID and global factors meant goods and energy prices were already high. Statistics published this morning show that inflation in February was 6.2%.
But during the same period, energy companies have reported record profits. City bonuses have gone up six times wages, and politicians have made it to the UK's rich list. Households have been promised a few hundred pounds in relief, but it won't even scratch the surface, as millions of families wonder where their next meal is coming from. Bianca Rahimi, London.
That's it for your latest here, everyone. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Nearly half of US Republicans have said mass shooting incidents should be accepted as part of a free society. Following strict messaging guidelines, Republican politicians repeatedly claim mental health and security issues are to blame for mass shooting incidents in the US, not access to guns. We now present you an article written by Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled, Poll Finds Nearly Half of Republicans Think US Has to Live with Mass Shootings. According to an opinion poll released in the aftermath of the Texas elementary school murders, and as politicians in Washington negotiate for gun reform, nearly half of Republican voters think the U.S. just has to live with mass shooting incidents. The CBS and YouGov opinion poll returned familiar results, including 62% support for a nationwide ban on semi-automatic rifles, the kind of gun used in Uvalde, Texas. 19 young children and 2 adults were killed at the Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas on 24th of May by an 18-year-old teenager who bought his weapon legally. But clear national support for a ban on such rifles or changes to purchasing ages and background checks is not mirrored in Congress. Most Republican politicians, supported financially by the powerful gun lobby, remain opposed to gun reform. In an effort fueled by horror at events in Uvalde, Texas, senators led by Chris Murphy, a Democrat from Connecticut, elected after the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting incident, which killed 26 in 2012, and John Cornyn, a Texas Republican, have expressed optimism that some changes may be possible. On Monday, 6th of June, Chris Murphy told NBC News, "Sometimes when we go away for a week, sensitive negotiations like this fall apart. This week, the opposite is happening, because my colleagues went home and heard the same thing I did. Parents are frightened to death." He said, "They're frightened to death for their kids, and they're frightened to death that government isn't going to be able to respond. The most fundamental concern the parents have, the safety of their children. I think senators are coming back to town today with a newfound resolve to get something done." Reporting on the Senate talks has largely focused on red flag laws designed to stop gun purchases by people deemed a potential danger to others or to themselves. In the CBS YouGov opinion poll, support for such laws ran at 72%. Senator Chris Murphy was asked, "Is this about incentivizing states to pass their own red flag laws or a federal one?" He said, "I actually don't think it will be a good idea to have a federal red flag law. I think it will be very inaccessible for local law enforcement to have to go to the federal court system. So I support the state laws. I think they need some guidance and some funding in order to implement these laws and make sure that everybody knows how to access them. A Senate reform package could also contain efforts to close loopholes in background checks." In the CBS YouGov opinion poll, support for federal background checks on all gun purchases ran at 81%. President Biden has called for an assault weapons ban, or at least raising the minimum age for purchases of guns. In the new opinion poll, 77% said the minimum age for buying an assault rifle should be higher than 18. 32% said it should be 21, and 45% said it should be over 25. Senator Chris Murphy said, "I think there's certainly Republican support for raising the age. I don't know whether there are 60 votes yet, and right now, my entire focus is on what can get 60 votes." But the new opinion poll's most telling evidence came when respondents were asked if mass shooting incidents were unfortunately something we have to accept as part of a free society, or something we can prevent and stop if we really tried. Among Democrats, 85% said mass shooting incidents could be stopped if U.S. politicians would only try. Among independent voters, the figure was 73%. Overall, it was 72%. But 44% of Republicans said mass shooting incidents should be accepted as part of a free society. Following strict messaging guidelines, Republican politicians repeatedly claimed mental health and security issues are to blame for mass shooting incidents and not access to guns. Those who took part in the opinion poll were also asked, regardless of how you feel about the issue, how likely do you think it is that Congress will pass any laws in the next few months that will make significant changes to gun policy? Only 7% thought it was very likely that Congress would act, while a combined 69% thought it was not very likely or not at all likely. Some state governments have passed the so-called reforms. In New York City, on Monday, 6th of June, the state governor, Kathy Hochul, signed a package of laws including licensing measures for assault rifles and a minimum purchase age of 21, expanded red flag provisions, and a ban on sales of body armor. Kathy Hochul told reporters, "It just keeps happening. Shots ring out, flags come down, and nothing ever changes, except here in New York." However, the state is home to another politician whose fate starkly shows what can happen to Republicans who express openness to gun reform. On Friday, 3rd of June, the New York Congressman Chris Jacobs abandoned his bid for re-election after stoking fury by expressing support for a federal assault weapons ban. Congressman Chris Jacobs represents a suburb of Buffalo, New York, the city in which 10 people were shot dead at a supermarket on 14th of May in what authorities say was a racially motivated attack. Mass shooting incidents, widely defined as shootings in which 4 people, excluding the gunman, are held or killed, have continued since the Buffalo incident and the elementary school shooting in Uvalde, Texas. Recently, at a hospital in Tulsa, Oklahoma, a gunman killed 2 doctors, a receptionist, and a patient. According to the nonprofit Gun Violence Archive, the following weekend saw mass shooting incidents in Philadelphia, Chattanooga, South Carolina, Arizona, Texas, Georgia, New York, and Michigan. 15 people were killed and more than 60 others were wounded. The archive says there have been 246 mass shooting incidents in the United States in 2022, considerably more than one a day. On Sunday, 5th of June, Senator Chris Murphy claimed, "The possibility of success is better than ever before, but I think the consequences of failure for our entire democracy are more significant than ever." According to a new opinion poll, most Americans believe the new legislation aimed at reducing gun violence should be prioritized over protecting gun rights. The ABC Ipsos opinion poll, which comes in the wake of a deadly string of mass shooting incidents in the U.S., said 7 out of 10 people in the country prioritize laws reducing gun violence over gun rights. The opinion poll showed only 21%, or less than one-third of those interviewed, believed that gun rights should be a higher priority than reducing gun violence in the country. Most Democrats said lawmakers should prioritize laws focused on reducing gun violence, while about half of the Republican respondents said protecting the rights of gun owners is a higher priority. The opinion poll was conducted from 3rd to 4th of June as the country mourned those killed in multiple mass shooting incidents, including 10 people at a grocery store in New York, 21 at an elementary school shooting in Uvalde, Texas. The political debate over gun control has been one of the most divisive issues in U.S. society for decades. The issue of gun control has culminated in a multi-million dollar lobbying campaign, congressional standoffs, and mass demonstrations for those for and against gun laws. The root of the debate is a single sentence in the U.S. Constitution, where the Second Amendment says, "A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." A dispute on the interpretation of the Second Amendment separates the Democrats, who believe in stricter gun control laws, from the Republicans, who see any such legislation as an infringement of their gun rights.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Lovely listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Muslim Lady. In the studio with me, I have the privilege and honor of being joined by Sister Salma Khalfan. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
Thank you so very much for being with us, sharing your time with us.
The pleasure is mine.
Thank you. So on the previous episode, we were trying to rediscover, actually, the different aspects of motherhood and how a woman, how a determined, strong Muslim lady can find her identity. Because oftentimes I feel like a lot of the mothers I see, because number one, like you said on the previous episode, there is no like monetary value placed on motherhood, right? And in today's age, everything is measured by how much money it earns us. That's the value we place on it. But there's no such thing happening with money. I mean, it's quite the opposite. You got to spend a lot of money to be a good mom.
I guess so. But if the conviction is there that Allah will give you bighayri hisab, it becomes such a pleasure, you know?
Mm.
And He does.
Without
There's so many examples I have near, you know, like myself, that I feel that when children are coming, the parents want to provide them the best schools and they're worried about the fees.
So much,
and you see, lo and behold, the risk is increasing, so that we just realize that how did our children grow up with the best kind of education,
mashallah,
which we really wanted for them to have. And we see that in front of our eyes. So everything is promised by Allah, the risk of the bodily risk, the spiritual risk, and also the intellectual risk, but you have to channel that in the right direction.
Of course, yes. That's so important. It's so important that you said it's already there. You just got to channel it, and how most, if not all of it, is a matter of perspective. Because I think another aspect other than the whole money thing that makes a woman feel like she's losing her identity and sense of self through becoming a mother is that it's so underappreciated. And I understand that a lot of that support hasn't directly come from her spouse, because at the end of the day, no one can encourage her as much as the father of her children.
Yeah.
But let's assume a situation where that's not happening as much as it should, or it is, but she still feels lost. What can a woman do, a mother do, to strengthen that identity and be able to appreciate what she's doing for her children?
You see, the thing is, like, when we think that, okay, she's using all her time and energy for the child, it doesn't mean that she should not regard herself also in the process. So while she's doing it, she should allocate her own time, the me time that we usually call it, in a way to enhance the child to learn. For example, if the me time is the spirituality time, she feels like reading the Holy Quran often. And now the baby has come, you know, in olden times, I remember the parents used to say, I don't even have time to pray. That's completely wrong. I've heard that myself and I was so amazed and I was so sad about it. I felt that how come we all did that, you know, but them thinking that they couldn't do it because they were so, you know, like busy doing the child upbringing, and that's where they're lost, you know. They don't realize that these things are actually teaching the child and getting that good energy for them, you know, that positive energy. The spiritual energy is so strong that in the house, the Holy Quran is being recited, prayer is, you know, like enacted. The child will learn to sit near the prayer mat. And she or he will learn also to do a sajda at a very young age. See? So all these things need to be inculcated, and that it becomes a pleasure, you know, for the parent. So the parent doesn't lose out on anything. if they are smart parents. They can get their walk, and they can even give that time to the child. They can talk to the child. In fact, they can talk such good things, read stories to the child. So the time is, yeah, and the parent, you know, they learn how to be creative even. You know, there's a hadith that is a very beautiful hadith that says, if you practice what you know, Allah will teach you what you don't know.
Beautiful.
Yeah, so a parent is the most vivid example of such a case that I remember myself also. Just instinct tells me, do this, do that, you know. Like, for example, when they're sick, why don't you try this? Why don't you try? A voice like telling you. So it's a very beautiful experience, especially when you see the results that, oh, I did it. You feel a sense of achievement.
Mashallah.
And then you see your child happy. And that gives you such a deep satisfaction that I think no money in the world and no degree in the world and no working outside in the world with the co-mates or whatever, the workers, that friendship that you have, I mean, that couldn't replace that. Only one has to experience it to know it, I guess. Mm. So parents out there, you know, lag behind because they themselves have a complex about motherhood, as we'll keep on seeing how many qualities it improves for her to help her in this world and also the hereafter, which is the everlasting life.
Yes, yes.
And which we want for ourselves, betterment, and our children. Always the thought of getting the betterment of the hereafter, the abadi world, the eternal world should be in our mind also as we pass on through this stage of parenthood.
That's such an interesting way of looking at it. How you explain that not only can she establish a strong, wholesome, healthy identity within motherhood for herself, but by doing so, by strengthening her identity, she can be a good role model for her children.
That's right.
You do the things that you enjoy doing within the framework of your value system, and then through the years, you're going to see how it manifests in your child.
Yeah, and gives you such a reward.
It reminds me again of that hadith from Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, where he says, don't invite people to religion just through your tongue and your words, but rather your actions.
Yeah.
And that's what a mom is doing.
Yeah.
And the essence of it all, just by being a good person and a good Muslim lady,
yeah,
she is automatically being the best mom she can be.
That's right, absolutely.
That is so wonderful.
And then when we go and see when she's doing this in the process, she's becoming so humane.
Mm, mashallah.
You know, and that humanity, when it seeps inside a person, that's when actually what Allah really wants from us, mm-hmm, becoming a human being. In other areas, she will see the fruit of it,
mm-hmm,
with her husband, with the people around her that care and, you know, that support among her friends, among her parents. And you must have heard this often, that when a girl gets married and gets children, that's when she realizes how much her parents worked for her.
For sure.
Yeah, yeah. That's the time she realizes that, oh, my parents took so much trouble for me. And that's when she has that worthiness of the parents more than she had when she was a spinster.
Mm.
So this brings about, because it's a process of humanity. Allah wants her to grow through this. And but it's a sad thing that, again, like, if they don't realize their position,
yeah,
the heavenly position,
mashallah,
then they are so mistaken and they're so limited to this, just this world, you know.
Yeah. By raising a child and helping them grow, you are growing yourself.
Yeah.
And the sense of gratitude you're developing throughout the journey and the appreciation you have for all the people who, you know, once aided you through this path when you were, you know, nothing but a helpless little toddler.
Yeah, yeah.
How patient moms
are. Yeah, that's another
are.
Factor, you know, to be talked about, like patience grows in you. All these things are, they're part of the life. Every moment is a test, right? Patience is an ingredient that is so important in everyone's lives, be they Muslims or non-Muslims, be they parents or non-parents, or, you know, like they're just growing people, like youth. So they need this patience in every step of life. Even if we want a pleasure, it requires a patience.
True.
For example, if you want to have our food, patient and wait, that self-control control. It's so sweet. And Wallahu yuhibbu sabirin. Wallahu yuwaffa sabiruna bighayri hisab.
He loves the patient.
Yeah, like he gives a reward bighayri hisab. And in Allah, ma'as sabirin, Allah is with the, not we are with. And beautiful. That's a beautiful thing. When Allah is with you, He takes the first step that I want to be with you. Mm. So patience is a very beautiful thing. It just requires a little exercise, you know, in life. And that exercise is given through what parenthood? The Muslim lady.
Wow.
Yeah.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
The Muslim lady, if she knew her worth, she would just keep on, you know, doing the best day by day, day in, day out, and feel that and raise to the perfection.
That's definitely true. If she's reminded, do you think that we should create as a society, as a community, as a Muslim community, we should create more windows where our Muslim sisters are reminded of their valuable status as mothers or just as practicing Muslim women? And are we doing that enough, really, reminding them? Because God knows media is doing a lot of reminding,
right.
of, you know, how you should hashtag be living your best life, and you should be a girl boss, and you should have all the money, and should be competing with the men, and feminism, and be popular. And the world is reminding them so much of this. Are we doing enough to remind them of the value Allah has placed for them?
Unfortunately, no. But yeah, there are some communities who try their best, like to, you know, promote this the value of parenthood. Okay, giving lectures and everything is not enough, I feel. But like setting up competitions, challenges, that which mother, you know, plays with the child every day. You know, mark that up send it for us. Or which mother, for example, does her spiritual devotions near her child so that the child can see and learn. And that should be in such a beautiful manner that when the child, you know, feels that positive energy, it's not as if that, you know, like when a person is praying and the child kind of grabs the veil or the chador of the mother, then the mother distracts him and things like that. No, it should be done with proper equilibrium, peace, happiness, pleasure, like the Holy Prophet, you know, when Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein were on his back, he waited and, you know, he prolonged his sajda. And that was a very sweet gesture. And that was teaching us, his ummah, that, you know, you have to do even some things like this to encourage your children to love doing this. When you take them to the mosque, you know, after that you take them to the park so that they can feel there's a treat.
It becomes a core memory for them.
It is,
And they associate those wonderful feelings with going to the masjid and watching grandma or mom pray. Something else, I mean, we can't constantly, I myself criticize social media all the time. A lot of Muslim ladies out there do what you said, where they post the little accomplishments of their babies and, you know, they give tips and hacks about how to spend quality time with each other and turn routine everyday actions, whether it's like daily prayers or, you know, actual daily material thing, worldly things. And they post it on their social media and they encourage one another and they inspire other women.
I think that's a nice initiative too.
That's
a beautiful way also now that media is so prevalent, you know. And also like you're thinking of new ideas all the time. You know, like how they say that every 10 years new tafsirs should be written,
new
commentaries should be written. The same way, new ideas should be thought of how to enhance this, you know, and promote this value of parenthood, encouraging parents themselves that how, you know, like you know, how valuable she is to her community, especially where there are communities, small communities. Bring them forward in such a way that they're an example, you know.
Mashallah.
And then see that they, for example, little children have grown and how they have grown, and then they talk about it, that, you know, like what they used to do.
MashaAllah.
That's the very thing. I know of a lady who is so old and she's got maybe even grandchildren, but a young girl comes up to her and tells her, how did you bring up your children?
Oh,
so people notice this thing.
How inspiring.
Yeah, how did you bring up your children that they are all like this, so great and so like successful and so beautiful etiquette and things like that.
That's
so,
definitely very gratifying.
People check out these things, role
yes,
models.
Yes, they
you know,
do.
And they want that to, you know, to do it for themselves as well.
Thank you so very much, Sister Sanma. And thank you to our listeners for being with us on this episode of Muslim Lady. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The House Select Committee investigating the U.S. Capitol attack on 6th of January 2021 intends to reveal previously secret White House records, photographs, and videos to prove how former U.S. President Donald Trump broke the law. We have prepared for you an article written by Hugo Lowell. The piece is titled U.S. Capitol Attack Panel to Unveil New Evidence Against Trump at Public Hearings. The House Select Committee investigating the U.S. Capitol attack will unveil new evidence at Watergate-style public hearings showing that Donald Trump and his top aides acted with corrupt intent to stop Joe Biden's certification. According to sources close to the inquiry, the House panel intends to use the hearings as its principal method of revealing potential crimes by Donald Trump as he sought to overturn the 2020 election results, in what could be a treacherous legal and political moment for the former president. As the Justice Department mounts parallel investigations into the Capitol attack, the House Select Committee is hoping that the previously unseen evidence will leave an indelible mark on the American public about the extent to which Donald Trump went in trying to return himself to the Oval Office. Norman Ornstein, a political scientist and emeritus scholar at the conservative think tank the American Enterprise Institute, said of the hearings, "They're important for setting a record for posterity. but they're also important for jolting the American public into realizing what a direct threat we had coming from the highest levels of government to illegitimately install a president who had lost the election. The sources said the panel's ambitions for the hearings were twofold: presenting the basis for charging Donald Trump broke the law and placing the Capitol attack in a broader context of efforts to overturn the election, with the former president's involvement as the central thread. The sources said at their heart, the hearings are about distilling thousands of communications between top Trump White House aides and operatives outside the administration and the Trump campaign into a compelling narrative of events about the events of 6th of January. In order to tell that story, the sources said, the House Select Committee intends to have its senior investigative counsels reveal previously secret White House records, photographs and videos that will be presented in real time to starkly illustrate the live witness testimony. On Thursday night, 9th of June, at the annual hearing at 8 p.m. local time, the panel's chairman, Benny Thompson, and the vice chair, Liz Cheney, are likely to make opening arguments, outline a roadmap for the hearings, and give an overview of the events of 6th of January 2021 and the preceding weeks. The panel is likely to focus on broad themes for the following four hearings, such as how Donald Trump used false claims of voter fraud to undermine the 2020 election and future races, and how he tried to use fake electors to deceive Congress into returning him to office. House investigators are also likely to focus on how Donald Trump directly pivoted to the 6th of January congressional certification and not the December deadlines for states to certify their electors as an inflection point, and how his actions led straight to militia and far-right groups' covert maneuverings. The House panel is then likely to reserve its most explosive revelations for the final hearing in prime time, where the Select Committee members, Adam Kinzinger and Elaine Luria, are expected to run through Donald Trump's actions and inactions as the 6th of January attack unfolded. The sources said the list of witnesses has not yet been finalized, but it is expected to include top aides to former Vice President Mike Pence, top aides to Donald Trump's former Chief of Staff, Mark Meadows, and people with direct knowledge of militia group activities on 6th of January 2021. From a legal perspective, the House panel has already charged in court filings that Donald Trump and his external legal advisor, John Eastman, violated multiple federal laws to overturn the 2020 election outcome, including obstruction of Congress and defrauding the United States. The sources said the Select Committee hopes that by revealing new evidence in hearings, it can convince beyond a reasonable doubt the American public and potentially the Justice Department that the former president violated laws to reverse his 2020 election defeat. Among the highlights of the already public evidence, including the revelation that John Eastman, Donald Trump's external legal advisor, admitted to Mike Pence's counsel, Greg Jacob, that his scheme to obstruct Congress on 6th of January was actually unlawful, but pressed ahead with it anyway. Meanwhile, the internal White House schedule for 6th of January that the House Select Committee obtained through the National Archives showed that Donald Trump would have known he had no plans to march with the crowd to the capital when he falsely promised that at the Ellipse rally. The sources said House investigators are in many ways making their case to the American public, since it is not certain the panel will make criminal referrals to federal prosecutors, given they are not binding on the Justice Department, which has the sole authority to file charges. But that quest will come with its own challenges, with the House panel's greatest difficulty in perhaps not so much whether they can show wrongdoing by Donald Trump and his top advisers, but whether it can get Republican and independent voters to care. The repeated delays in holding the hearings have meant House investigators were able to finish most of the evidence gathering they intended to conduct. The committee initially anticipated holding them sometime in the spring, then in April, and then in May, and now in June. According to two sources familiar with the inquiry, committee counsel recently told one witness, who had been assisting the investigation for months, that it didn't expect to ask for any more assistance. The counsel told that particular witness, "We are pretty much done." But the consequence of the decision to delay the start of public hearings and the constant drip of news from the investigation is that it might have driven some 6th of January fatigue, which Donald Trump's allies on Capitol Hill are intent on weaponizing to defend Trump. According to party aides, the former president's most ardent defenders in Congress and top Republicans led by the House Minority Leader, Kevin McCarthy, are planning aggressive counter-programming to the public hearings that slammed the panel as partisan. Vox earlier reported the Republican National Committee has also circulated a one-page memo of talking points requesting that Donald Trump's surrogates attack the investigation as rigged, even though multiple federal courts have ruled the inquiry is fully legitimate.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.